This is a Pinball News production.
So, hi, I'm Clay Harrell. Maybe the title in the seminar or in the brochure that Rob put out is maybe a little deceiving. What we're really going to talk about is how to open a pinball museum and all the pitfalls and mistakes that I actually made doing this. It took me a lot of years to get to an actual building, but I guess it's kind of like everybody's history has been like that. Heck, it took Tim Arnold close to 10 years before he opened his Pinball Hall of Fame, and the PPM in San Francisco, they took a while before they got running. There's always an evolution, and the way we started was a club. We started with a club, and what happened is I got a Rite Aid drugstore for free by supporting a local high school with their all-night senior party. So what happened is that this Rite Aid drugstore closed. They had 5,500 square feet where they could prepare props for this party they would have every year, where they would lock the seniors into the gym for all night so they wouldn't fuck and drink themselves to death on the night they graduate. Oh, by the way, did I mention I'm probably going to swear? So if that offends you, now's a good time to leave. So anyways, they said, why don't you have some pinball machines? And they contacted me, and they had all this space. So I just started filling up this 5,500 square foot with machines, because, you know, that's kind of what happens, is that when you buy machines, you just expand to the space you were given. And this kind of worked well for a couple years, but then they started to get mad at me because I would actually fill up the place, like really fill up the place. See, they only needed this for one night a year, and I means the other 364 days of the year, we could have pinball parties there. And that's what we did for like 2 years. We would have parties all the time. And then eventually this one day a year, we would bring our games to the high school. And there's my wife and me. I would bring bowlers. I would bring pinballs. I bring anything coin operated, even Pac-Man machine, but mostly pinballs. And we would set up and let the kids play them. And then we would, you know, do it. But eventually, like I said, they got mad. Free is never free. Even though we got the space for free, you can never think of things as free, because there's always something associated with a cost. Here, Duncan, hit pause for me. The other thing, too, is don't be space greedy when somebody offers you something for free. In my case, I had bought a container of games and put them all into the space, and then the people from the senior all-night party just happened to drop in and saw that the entire drugstore was filled with like 100 pinball machines. And even though it was a temporary thing, they didn't understand that, and that's eventually what got me kicked out of that whole thing. So then I'm forced to put sell my games, fire sale them, and the few that I had left put into storage, and we started this EM club thing where we would go to people's houses. But the problem is that not everybody has the same enthusiasm that I had, and it turns out that I was hosting every month, me and one other guy. We would just go back and forth, and that got really old really quick. So we did it for a couple summers, and it worked really, really well, because during the summer, you know, there's no school. They're not even thinking about it. But then I got this second opportunity called Crazy Carl's, which was a video store. Now, in 2009, 2010, video was already starting to fail, but Crazy Carl had a back room where he was renting porno, and that was really what was keeping him alive. But he liked pinball, and Carl was this really odd guy, and he drank a lot too, which probably helped. So we would have pinball machines, and I filled it up mostly with EMs because they were low cost. You can see over here, see all the videos over there? So, you know, he was really gracious about the whole thing. And we would have tournaments and just parties there, and we had a ton of fun. And then one day, Carl came to me and said, we're closing, I got to be out in 2 weeks. And I was just like, well, what the heck's going on? And the reason why he was closing is because his business was decaying, but his landlord didn't understand that, and his landlord wouldn't reduce his rent. So, you know, Carl was basically forced out of business just due to rising costs and Netflix or what have you. You know, I mean, it was crazy. So he couldn't get the landlord to budge on rent reduction. And to this day, that store is still not rented. So this was really stupid on the landlord's part. So in a 2-week period, and it's 2010, during the recession, and this is in the outskirts of Detroit, kind of put this all into perspective, there isn't a lot of money. We had my wife actually was looking for places for me to lease, so we went and leased a warehouse, and I got it for, I think it was $650 a month, and it was 2,400 square feet plus a mezzanine, hit play. And it was pretty cool. It was, you know, just an industrial center. It looked pretty discreet. And, you know, I told all my friends, and they all came over, and they helped me decorate it, and we fixed it up and, you know, rewired the electric because it really wasn't set up for pinball, made the mezzanine bigger. We did all kinds of really cool things that cost a lot of money, but really, and was really stupid on a leased property. Right there's my landlord, my former landlord. He was really friendly when I was giving him money. When I stopped giving him money, not so much. But you can see the mezzanine up here, and we actually expanded that to make it better. So here, hit pause. So we were paying $650 for 2,400 square feet, plus about 100 in electric, 30 in insurance, 150 for gas in the winter, 70 bucks for internet and TV. So, you know, my rough costs were $850 to $1,000 a month, hit play. So this worked great, but it was still coming directly out of my pocket. So I asked people to contribute. You know, you pay $100 a year, you can come anytime. I was there almost every night, and we would have parties once a month. So the cool thing about the parties is I would put them on Craigslist, say, pinball party, come, you know, bring your own, come play pinball, pay 20 bucks, hit pause, you know, you can have fun. And this worked good for about 3 months. And then I just noticed the people that were coming. I mean, you know, look around the room. We're all pinball people. We're fucking weird, okay? But this set a whole new standard of weird. I mean, it was like bizarre, the people that were coming in. And they were pigs. You know, just made a mess everywhere, threw up on everything, smoked everything. You know, it was terrible hit play. You know, so we stopped doing that. You know, we did it from like October to, I would say, January, maybe February, and we stopped doing the Craigslist thing, but the reputation had spread enough that people knew that we were doing, and we had a website where we would put, you know, the next party. I didn't have to do the Craigslist ad. That actually helped. It brought less people in, but it made things a lot more sane and not so crazy. So you can see this was like one of our first parties that we had expanded the mezzanine. This was something we all added across the back. You know, I had a lot of EMs, a lot of emphasis on EMs just because they were low-cost machines, generally lower in maintenance too, lower initial cost, just everything. And then upstairs, I installed 54-foot blacklight bulbs. I went to my local carpet guy and said, I need blacklight carpeting. He said, hey, we just put blacklight carpet in a roller rink, and I got a ton left over. You can have it for free. So we put the blacklight purple and orange all on the floors in the black lights above, and it really gave a very nice ambiance, but it also freaked some people out. Be careful with black light. It's not for everybody. But it was really neat. The mezzanine thing was great. You could look over and see everything. We hung the Christmas lights up from above. It was really quite festive. It was also a drunkard's paradise, too. I mean, people just loved to drink. See, we even got the sign. This was like right before we closed, right about here, because what happened is people were starting to take notice, and it was mostly the wrong people who were starting to take notice. There was, we hired waitresses from the local bar, too, to come and serve us drinks, because when you go to a pinball party, it's all guys, so it was always nice to have a few women around just to kind of spark things up a little bit. So, and of course, they would drink, too, on our dollar, but anyways, hit pause. So here, this was like one of the last ones. We had a videos playing up on the wall. We had a bunch of posters. We had all these people drinking. Had a pop machine, filled it with pop, except for the last two vendors. We had an American flag and a Canadian flag. If you hit the American flag, you got a Budweiser. If you hit the Canadian flag, you got a Labatt's. This was a really bad idea, okay? Because that's essentially for a dollar. So you put a dollar in, most people would hit the pop. But if you knew, you'd hit the Budweiser or the Labatt's thing, the American or the Canadian flag. This was bad, but not everybody knew about that, mostly just the guys that were, quote, in the club. So hit play again. So then what happened is we're preparing for our party in April, and I went in an hour early, or maybe a couple hours early, just to make sure everything was in order. And I clean up, and I come out, and as I'm locking the door, a fire truck pulls up. And this guy in a suit walks up to me and says, are you the owner of this place? And I'm like, I didn't even want to talk to the guy. Here, hit pause. I didn't even want to talk to the guy because I didn't know who the hell he was. I thought it was weird that he had an entourage of fire trucks, though. It turns out he was the city manager, and the fire trucks was the fire marshal, and they wanted to come in, something fierce, to inspect the place. And I basically told him to fuck off. You never want to do that to a city manager. They get really mad. And so I left for a couple hours, and I came back, and they had that yellow tape over the door with this condemned notice on the door, you know, like they didn't want us to be there. I said, fuck it. Ripped all that shit off, opened the door, we had our party. But we had unintended guests, too. We had the cops that kept coming by, and they would come in, and of course, we're all drinking and playing pinball, and they're like, wow, this is pretty cool. You really pissed somebody off down at the hall, though. They told us we got to hang out here all night, and we're going to be right outside watching you. Now, and a lot of people were doing left-hand smoking and that at prior events, so all that kind of shut that down because nobody wants to do that when the cops are outside. Bottom line was, I went to the city Monday morning and said, what's going on? Somebody had put an ad on Craigslist, not me, that said, let's see if I get this right, pinball, booze, and hookers, and put our address and the time of the party, and then send an email to the city manager pointing to the Craigslist thing. And of course, now, you know, and I didn't even know this at the time when I was talking to the guy. This kind of gave a negative presentation to the whole event, and I had to do a lot of explaining. Bottom line is, they shut us down. We had to close. And this is us closed. Basically, we emptied the whole place out. The only thing left was a ball bowler that took me a little while to move / sell. It was very, very disappointing. And it turns out that, like, our town... Hit play again for me, Duncan. Our town has, like, two kinds of pinball people. What I call the pinball Democrats, which would be us. Hit pause again. And the pinball Republicans, which are all about the money. And it turns out that we were kind of cutting into the money side of or what they felt we were cutting into their money side, having this inexpensive club and venue. And it just created a huge headache. So a couple things I learned. Be inclusive. That is, never tell anybody they can't come because you don't know who you're going to piss off. The pinball Republicans versus Democrat thing, I talked about that. Be careful whom you trust. Like, I should have known some things were starting to happen at the club that were interesting. Like, somebody would set off a stink bomb inside when we were having the parties, and it would basically evacuate the whole building. And honestly, God, I didn't know that it was, like, a stink bomb. I thought a sewer backed up. And this happened, like, several times, and it turns out some people... you know, my lieutenants, if you want to put it that way, actually knew what was going on, but they kind of failed to tell me whom was responsible for it. If I had known that, I could have kind of nipped a lot of this stuff off in the bud, but it just kind of, you know, just kept going up until the final closing, you know, when I could have probably had to, you know, head them off at the pass if I had known stuff ahead of time, if I had listened better and looked a little better. But anyways... the city manager agreed to go with me to other venues because they were pissed about the mezzanine. It was made out of wood. That's a bad thing. They want it metal. They were pissed about the electrical. We never got it inspected. They were pissed about basically everything. So I went with the city manager to look at new venues, and he was real helpful at first. But every time we'd find one that met his qualification and ours, I would say, okay, I'd send an email to him, say, okay, we're going to lease it. And then he would fire back with 10 new things I had to do. It needs to have a wash bucket with an open sink. And, you know, he'd basically constantly cock block me on everything that I wanted to do. And finally, it took me about a month or two, but I got the message that he really didn't want us there. So hit play again. So what we did is we opened up our next club. Of course, I don't listen well to city managers. Excuse me. And we created it a secret club. So we didn't tell anybody, and I just rented other warehouse space. And again, I didn't ask permission. There were some other things happening at the same time. I don't know if you guys remember Marvin3M.com and the repair guides and all this. There was a lot of shit that kind of snowballed all during this era that kind of was on the back of my neck, and it created a lot of problems. But anyways, so we opened up our fourth museum/club attempt, which was this Flipper City thing, the top secret thing. Now we had 130 games, where at Tilltown we only had 100, in smaller space but no mezzanine. So you can see that the aisles are much tighter here. The games are much more crammed in. But that was okay because we didn't have a mezzanine. If anybody walked in, didn't have to deal with that. And it was fun. We still had a lot of EMs, but I was starting to expand more into the solid state stuff. And we had good storage. It was a warehouse, but it had this limitation that we couldn't tell anybody about it. We couldn't have any kind of public event. It was just, you know, quote, club members. And everybody had a vow of silence. You know, the first rule of Fight Club is don't talk about Fight Club. Well, the first rule of Pinball Club is don't talk about Pinball Club. You know, that was okay, but it really limited what we could do. That made the guys on the other side of town, the Pinball Republicans, very happy because, you know, basically we couldn't advertise and cut in on their financial aspects of their pinball show, et cetera, et cetera. So we kind of lived in this limbo for 2 years, and finally I just got sick of it. This was the other problem, too. My rent went up dramatically. Hit pause for me, Duncan, because we're starting to come out of the recession. The warehouse space, when I moved in, it was like 50% empty. Now it's only about 10% empty. There was no incentive for the landlord to give me a deal anymore. So our rent went up. Electric was about the same. Insurance went up a little bit. Heat was roughly the same. TV and internet went up. But now I'm paying $1,250 to $1,400 a year hit play. I asked the people in the club to up their dues from $100 a year to $200 a year. But I'm still losing my ass. I'm getting in income, hit pause for me, $666 a month, but it's costing me $1,200 to $1,400. So I'm still heavily financing this. So what do you do? I mean, we've got this huge collection, and this was just the crap at the warehouse. At my house, I had another 100 games. So how do I take all this stuff and make it economic, hit play? Well, there's only one answer to that question. You don't. It's never going to work. I mean, if you think you're ever going to make money doing this, unless your name is Tim Arnold, hit pause for me. It's not going to work. Now, just to give, you see, I brought up Tim Arnold. And the reason why I brought up Tim is because he's one of the only people that has successfully taken a pinball venue and been able to make any kind of money out of it. And the reason he did that was he picked a state, Nevada, that has no tax or low taxes. Sells it as a museum when it's really not. It's really an arcade, but he got away with it, so he doesn't have to pay any fees on the games. He went through the city, got everything approved, but mostly he's in Las Vegas. He's in a destination, okay? I mean, people go to Las Vegas all the time for party and fun. Same thing with the guys in San Francisco. That's a destination. Detroit is a fucking shithole, okay? It's not a destination, okay? I mean, it's nothing. It's like the toilet, you know? People don't go to Detroit for anything but to die, okay? I mean, that's just how it is. You know, so I'm not ready to move to, you know, some, you know, great place. So we had to live within this. So I just nutted up, and we decided to do it big, hit play. So instead, hit pause. My wife, again, bless her soul, was searching for a new house because we wanted to move out of the area we were in because our kid was now in college and he didn't need the school system. So it was pretty high taxes. And we were going to want it to move out in the country. So she found an old VFW hall, Veterans of Foreign Wars is what VFW stands for. And they were closing because, everybody gets on Facebook now. Apparently they don't actually go and drink beers together, at least as far as vets are concerned. So they were closing this place, and it was cheap. I mean, it was really cheap. It was on 10 acres, It was 6,600 square foot, and then it had a large garage outside that we actually expanded into an annex to give us another 3,000 square foot. So we bought it. I shouldn't say we. I bought it. Okay, to back up, to get the approval for this, because I decided that running under the radar, you know, you're only going to get so far with that. So I wanted to do it official. So I went to the city and told them what I wanted to do, that I was basically buying the VFW hall, that, you know, we were going to put pinball machines on it, you know, we'd have some friends over, and, you know, that's about it. And they just shit a brick. They said, no, you cannot do that. You know, and I'm like, why? He says, well, it's zoned residential, R2. And I'm like, but it's a VFW hall. But it finds out the VFW hall has been there since 1947, before they were grandfathered in, basically, before all the zoning. So then the guy that was working there pulled me aside and he said, hey, I really like what you're doing. You know, R2 zoning has exemptions for daycare. And I said, I don't know if I could classify adult daycare. And he goes, no. Also for museums. Why don't you call it a museum? He said, just resubmit the paperwork as a museum. And I'm like, all right, good idea. So I resubmit the paperwork as a museum. It's got to get a zoning variance. So I got to go in front of the city. They all vote for it. I couldn't believe it. But they did handcuff me a little bit. They said you can only be open, you know, up to 4 weekends a year. They didn't want it open every day. I didn't understand why, because you'll see the pictures in a minute that it really doesn't make any sense. But anyways, hit play. So I decided it was going to be a museum. You know, I mean, this was kind of accidental. I mean, we were just going to a club that wanted to put all my crappy pinball machines in. But now we're a museum, you know, and I'm like, okay, we can do this. And so here's the VFW hall. It's a little video that we did when we were buying it in a couple years ago. So it was kind of a shithole, to be honest with you. They didn't maintain it very well when we bought it. It had these hallways or these little offices up front. That guy's the VFW commander of the post. He was a nut, too. You can see that everything here was basically wide open. This looked pretty good. But every time we would go, we would find something else we didn't like or that we knew we had to change. And we ended up basically gutting the whole place, even though it doesn't really look like it needed much gutting. And it had a bunch of kitchen equipment, too, that was all worthless. More offices that all had to be imploded. But it was a building, and it had a new heating system, which was a plus, and new air conditioning. So it looked like a good fit. It had a 24-foot bar, which is great because a lot of guys like to drink and play pinball. It will come into the kitchen. This, I envisioned, boy, I can gut this and turn it into a nice little pinball workshop. You know, it had fryers and, you know, sinks and dishwashers and all that stuff. You know, it looked like it was a good fit. I mean, it's got standard bar stuff. And then you go in the back. This room, that's the kitchen, sorry. This room right here was what was called the fish room, because VFWs every Friday, they have fish fries. They would prepare fish in there. It smelled like fish. And then this room, I don't know, God, what this was, but it had this refrigerator in it that was wider than the door. They put that in there and then framed it all around. Getting all this stuff out was a headache, but basically we knocked all the walls down to get all this stuff out. Oh, and a walk-in safe. Oh, my God, that was a hassle because it was filled with concrete some other carcinogen we ended up giving it away, but somebody actually came and took it. And then here's the garage that we basically gutted and expanded. So it looked like a good deal at the time, but it turns out that we had to do just a crap load of work to make this place usable, at least for us. Also, I had to have the electric all redone. They had tons of power coming in, but they didn't have it dispersed through the building very well. So now here it is. We got a new roof. We actually did a Kickstarter campaign for the roof. That was the only money I asked for outside of my pocket. We did a Kickstarter campaign, and we got like $10,000 for a roof. And in return, people got to come to the VFW, you know, for a visit, or they got a T-shirt, or you know how a Kickstart thing works. There's the garage, how we expanded it and filled that all with games. And you can see we're on 10 acres. We got some beehives back there. I got a beekeeper that likes, I don't know, he makes honey for us. Like I got a use for honey. But anyways, the offices, we got it and just opened everything up. Installed a bunch of outlets for all the stuff and just started populating it with games. So the cool thing is that we have a really good selection of games. We have 300 games in the facility. Probably about 225 in this side and then 75 in the annex. So a total of 300 games. And we have like almost a complete collection of Stern M200s, WPCs. We have all but like the four shittiest ones, like Popeye, Black Rose, and Gilligan's Island. You know, just the crap. I'm not into this, we got to complete the collection and keep the crap thing. I would rather just keep good games. So we got a lot of stuff, you know, all early Data East. We have almost an entire collection of early Data East, all, you know, the good wedge heads from the 60s and 70s, lots of the good wood rails, including Mermaid and Daisy May and Dragonette and all that stuff. We got pretty much nearly every System 11. We have a really good representation, lots of multiplayer EMs, you know, all the good ones. We have a really good representation of games. We have a great workshop. You can see right there was where the fryers were. That's all taken out. We got thousands in parts, you know, drill presses. We got everything. And then we got that back room where the fish room is. This was the fish room. You can see we've got more games, kind of the high-end stuff back here. And just tons of stuff. And it worked out really, really well. And so... Oh, here's pause for me. Here's what we have. We have almost a complete collection of Zachariah Generation 2 games, tons of System 80s. We got basically everything covered. I mean, as far as games go, we've got a really good representation, hit play, of pinball post-war. We don't really have any pre-war stuff, so you know, I'll leave that for other museums, but that's not really our gig. So... the question is now how do we pay for this? We have a yearly pinball show in May, in the middle of May. It doesn't really cover the costs. Matter of fact, it doesn't even come near covering the costs. But hit pause. But we now have a permanent home for 300 games. And the guys that are in the club, I don't have to ask for dues anymore. All I ask for is their help. Okay, so since everything is paid for, there's no mortgage... the show basically pays for, hit play again for me, pays for the heat and the taxes because now we are not a nonprofit, okay? I know a lot of the museums are nonprofits, but to be honest with you, I hit pause for me. I'm not big on the nonprofit thing. It's just another controlling entity, the government. And I don't want to report to anybody about anything, and I don't want anybody telling me what I can and cannot do. When you're a nonprofit, you have to be charitable to the community, and there's a bunch of other criteria you have to do to fit in that, and I just didn't want to do that, plus the hassle of the paperwork. And it is much harder to become a 501c3 or whatever it is now than it used to be. So it just didn't seem like a good fit. And in the end, what was it going to do? It would... kill our property taxes from about $3,000 a year down to zero a year. And to me, it just wasn't worth the trouble. Hit play. So that's where we ended up. And we used the show to pay for, you know, like I said, the taxes and the heat and some other, you know, building maintenance and stuff like that. And it's actually worked out pretty good. We're coming up on our third show this year. And the other good thing about this show... I have some drone footage here. I'll just talk over this. This will give you an idea, like, where we are as far as, like, you'll see how country it is. But the interesting thing is we're only about a mile off the highway outside of, you know, we're just about 8 miles north of Ann Arbor, Michigan. And but you can see it's real country. Across the street, I got an excavation yard. The other two sides of me are surrounded by an organic farm. So basically, people aren't going to bother us. And we can have, we can pretty much do what we want. And I find that the city has pretty much left us alone because I went through the trouble of getting all this court approved. So it's worked out really well. Over here on the left, you can see we've got a little snack shack. It's like a little building that we use during the show to, like, you know, serve hot dogs and soda pops and stuff like that. So you can see it's real country, but, you know, that's good. Yeah, now, is it Las Vegas? No, it's clearly not. But on the other hand, what we paid for this building was probably 1/20th what Tim Arnold paid for his. So, you know, and our taxes are manageable. Everything is pretty manageable. The worst part is the heat. The heating the building is expensive because it isn't kind of an older building. So anyways, that's kind of where we ended up and kind of the pitfalls and all the troubles that we got in and I tried to get out of to make this all happen. And people say, well, why can't you be open every day? Well, frankly, I don't want to be open every day. I mean, we have a club of like 40 to 50 guys. They come by every Friday night. We drink beer and play pinball, and we have a lot of fun. And then once a year, we have a show where we invite the whole damn world to come in, and they can play pinball with us. So what this does is it allows us to maintain the games, see what's going on as far as like how they work. And then in the show runs pretty, I won't say flawlessly, but it runs really well because all the games have a history. The big problem with pinball shows, like even this show, is that you don't never know when you walk in what games are going to be there, and you don't know the history behind them. Some people are really good. They bring really nice games. Some people bring really crappy games, and some games are hacked on the inside if somebody has to work on them, and some games aren't. But we know exactly all our games and their soft spots and what seems to work well and what doesn't, and then we can make adjustments around that. We've got a parts department right on facility. We've got a machine shop. We've got everything there to keep everything maintained. So our show runs very, very well. Now, do we have seminars like this at the show? No, we don't do seminars, and I'll tell you why. How many people do you think come to this show? Just a guess. How many? No, maybe to this seminar, 50, but come to the actual show, thousands, okay? And there's probably 50 people, 75 people in this room. You go ahead, do that math. What percentage is it? It's like 1%, 2%. Same thing with tournament guys. How many people participate in the tournament compared to the total attendance that come in? It's, again, a fairly low number. Wait, maybe 5%? So to cater to these very small percentages, I would rather cater to the 90 or 95% and have a good working collection of games that everybody can come in and just play. Now, do we have tournaments? Of course we have tournaments, but I don't put emphasis on them because I feel it's a distraction. Does that make tournament people happy? Probably not, but we try and have tournaments that are fun. Like this year, we're going to have the Italian Pinball World Championships. I like to come up with these grandiose names. It's awesome. Last year, we had the EM Pinball World Championships. You know, what does that mean? It doesn't mean shit, but it sounds really good. You know, so we have these tournaments, you know, with these machines, either all on EMs or all on Zacharias, or I'll probably come up with, you know, the System 11 Pinball World Championship next or whatever. But it's an interesting name, but does it bring in the high-end players? No, but it brings in a lot of people that have never competed before, and then they bring home a trophy, which they, competing against Zach Sharp or whomever, they would never have a chance to get. So I try and cater to that kind of a tournament, opposed to, you know, paying out big money and IFPA points. I kind of tend to ignore that stuff because I think it's, to be honest with you, I don't think that stuff really helps pinball. I think that helps the 15 people that are at the top of that, but it doesn't help the other 98% of the masses, which is who I'm trying to cater to. So we try and do things a little differently. And also another interesting thing is I limit attendance at the show. We usually sell out on Saturdays. Now, that sounds really stupid. Now, who would run a pinball show and limit attendance? That is ridiculously dumb. Well, it is dumb until you go to the show and you can walk right up to Medieval Madness and play it. There's no line. You can walk right up to Cactus Canyon. You can walk right up to the Joust. There's no line because we try and keep the numbers game to people ratio more or less 1-to-1. So there's always free machines open, and this provides a better player experience. So, and also, to be honest with you, you know, we're not in Chicago. We're not going to get 5,000 people through the door like they do here. You know, it's just not going to happen. We're not, you know, a go-to spot. Again, who the fuck goes to Detroit for anything? Nobody, you know. I've asked people to come, you know, will you come to our show? Well, where is it? It's Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is code for saying it's in shithole Detroit. And people get that, and they're like, I didn't renew my concealed carry license this year. I don't think I'm going, you know. So, and I tell them the deer are not, you know, we have a lot of deer on the facility. I have cameras set up every night. The deer come by and eat my grass and my apples. We got apple trees. They eat the apples. So we got to let a deer. I noticed the deer don't carry any ammunition, so. You know, I think we're pretty safe. But anyways, that's how we got here. And if any of you guys are interested in doing clubs or museums, you know, feel free to ask me some questions or, you know, now or later. And, you know, I can tell you all about, you know, all the kind of mistakes that we've made and the things that have worked and have not. Hi.
Did the city want to have any kind of demonstration that this is a real museum and it's educational in any way?
Was the city supportive, you mean, and like...
Did they insist on any proof that this is an actual educational type of stuff?
Okay, so did the city have any proof to require us to that we were really acting as a museum? The short question is no. I think they kind of got that I, even though I was applying as a museum, that we weren't really going to act as one. Because originally when I filed the paperwork with the city, they said, so you're going to be a museum. That's cool. We like that idea. So, but we don't want you to ever be open. And I was like, what? So wait, what the fuck does that mean? I mean, I literally said that to the guy because I'm like, how can you be a museum and never be open? Well, I don't know, but that's what you're going to do. And so then I went, you know, I wrote up a proposal and said, you know, we need to be open at some point. And they're like, well, how often? And I said, well, one weekend a quarter. And they're like, okay, that sounds good. You know, I probably could have said once a month or even, you know, once a week. I probably could have pushed it further. But I didn't know, you know, sometimes you can walk right up the line, but you don't want to walk over it. And I wasn't sure where that line was. So I didn't want to push them too hard or too, I didn't want to do too much work, I guess is what it came down to. You know, I didn't want to become a problem. So we're not a problem. I mean, the cops never come by. I mean, I don't even know if anybody knows where we are. We're literally on a dirt road. It's a good dirt road, though. So, I mean, it's not something that anybody's going to trip across. We don't even have signage. You know, you would have to know if you go to the website, you got to look to find the address. I mean, it's there, but you got to look. So, you know, I'm okay with all this. I mean, do I have a dreams of being open every day like Tim Arnold? No, I think that's more like a nightmare myself. I mean, I see what he goes through and the condition of his games and you know, all the work he has to do and the people. You know, like he has to clean shit off the walls in his bathroom about once a month because he's got the masked shitter that comes in and literally paints the walls with their ass. Now, do I want to do something like that? No. No, that's not in my to-do list, my bucket list. So I'm kind of happy with the way we're doing this. Is it as good as it could be? Probably not. It would be better if we were a little more public, but I'm okay with it. There's the long answer to your short question. So anybody else got any questions? Yes, sir.
Far in advance, do you have to purchase the tickets?
Yeah, we have limited attendance for our show. So our show's in May. We start selling tickets January 1st. Usually Saturday is like the big day. We're, you know, the show is Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Saturday seems to be the magical day that everybody wants to come. I do not know why. If it was me, that would be the worst day to come. But, you know, whatever. I always like the first day of shows, personally. Like this show, I love being here on Thursday, you know, because everything is fresh. There's still lots of parts for sale. The games aren't broken. Everything is really intact. Come Saturday, vendors are starting to close down. People are starting to bring their games home. They want to get home for Sunday football or what have you. So personally, I like to come there. But to answer your question, Saturday usually sells out a few weeks in advance. So, you know, usually by the end of April, we're kind of sold out on Saturday. But Friday and Sunday are usually wide open. So it's just that magical Saturday, you know. And the hours for Saturday are wider, too. And not everybody shows up at once. So, you know, you can kind of do the math. But I would say generally Saturdays are a little, the game-to-people ratio is slightly different than give Fridays or Sundays. So, any other questions?
Yeah, I presume there must. What airport would you fly into? Detroit Airport?
Well, yeah, there's actually two airports, and they're about equally spaced. There's the Detroit DTW Airport, but there's also Flint. Flint's a smaller airport, but it is a full-service, full-sized airport. It just depends where you're coming from. Like, if you're coming from New York City, it's probably going to be cheaper to fly to DTW than it would be to Flint, but Flint is a really nice airport to fly into. The security is low. You can park a car within walking distance. You know, Detroit's just—it's like a mini LaGuardia. I mean, it's a nightmare.
And how about like hotels or something?
Yeah, there's hotels. There is hotels nearby. I mean, not on the premises. Oh, another thing we offer is camping. We've got all this space, and a lot of people do this. Yeah, they bring tents and they camp overnight, and it costs like, I don't know, I charge them 10 or 20 bucks. And then Friday and Saturday night for the campers, we're open all night. So if you're a camper, you get to play all night. So we close it for everybody else, but for the campers, a portion of the facility is open all night, which is fun. And we have midnight tournaments and stuff like that. And I hear, though I have not personally witnessed it, that there's beer and drinking.
Right. Well, my buddy Eddie Kramer, who repairs the games at Modern Pinball and huge pinball fan and idolizes you, as I do. Like, that's on our pinball bucket list. That's our pinball bucket list, and it's, you know, that's a big that's an important one. So we hope to see you there.
Wait. We got to pause for a second while Duncan gets his composure. Well, thank you. Even though Duncan may not appreciate that, I do. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions?
Well, it's about your, like, pinball classes. Like, when do they, like, start exactly?
My pinball what? I'm sorry.
Like, repair classes?
Oh, yeah. That's another thing we do with the museum is we offer repair classes. I don't do it a lot, but mostly I do it because the people in the club, I kind of try and keep everybody up to date on repair techniques and that because I want people involved that can, you know, fix a game. If a wire comes off a coil or if, you know, a coil's stuck on or a light bulb doesn't work or what have you. So we offer, you know, entry-level repair classes. We usually do it once or twice a year. We're probably about due for that. Another thing that I forgot to mention is on Black Friday, the Friday after Thanksgiving, we have a charity event that we're open that night from 8 to midnight. You can get in free if you bring canned goods, and then we donate them to a local Ann Arbor homeless shelter. So, you know, you could bring one can of soup or a whole case. Some people, you know, will do either or anything in between. And then last year we collected like over 800 pounds of canned goods for the homeless shelter. So that's another time of the year that we're open to. So any other questions?
I have 20 games. I live in Dallas, Texas. I use the Texas Pinball Festival, kind of what you do, except I don't really like moving games once a year.
Right.
So I'm kind of interested in doing the same thing as what you've done, but on a smaller scale. What do you recommend?
You mean you want to have a pinball show or you want to just rent warehouse space?
Rent warehouse space, or it doesn't have to be warehouse, but rent space, have my games there instead of my home, have my friends go there.
I can't speak to where you live, but we're, you know, for instance, if I was going to do this all, you know, was going to rent warehouse space, I would get a time machine and go back 4 years when the economy was crap. Because if you can lock in your lease rate then, it would have been awesome. Now, lease rates are way more expensive than I can personally afford. So what you need to do is just go to the newspaper or online and look for lease space. I just basically tried to find the cheapest thing I could. And the way it works is that most of them work on square footage, you know, a price per square foot. And then that is done two different ways. There's like one inclusive of taxes and one exclusive of taxes. And you got to ask which one they're pricing. There's a term for it, and it slips my mind. But ours was, pardon me?
Local
Yeah, triple net. That's exactly right. So way ours was not triple net. Ours was totally inclusive of everything. Ours was $650 a month, never be a penny more, never be a penny less for the our term of the lease. And I think I had signed it for a year or two. I can't remember initially. So you just got to ask a lot of questions, and they will realize that you're kind of a neophyte by the questions you ask. The other thing you could do is you can go through a real estate agent. There are guys or people that specialize in that sort of thing, finding people lease space. Usually the further out in the country you go, the cheaper it's going to be than if you want to be in the city. That is like if I was going to lease space where I am now, it would be really dirt cheap compared to being where we were, which was much more city. Because we were much closer to Detroit and one of the upscale suburbs. So, we did really good, but timing is everything. You know, we did it during the economic downfall. So that made a huge difference and allowed us to kind of go in. And when we bought this building, it was right on the edge of when property values were still pretty low. Now to buy property, even in crap hole Michigan, things are ramping up. You know, things are getting expensive again. So I would say if you're going to do it, start doing it now because time is your enemy. So, any other questions? All right, great. Hey, thanks a lot. If you got any other stuff, come by and see me. And thank you, Duncan.